In every age, God raises people up to speak the truth to the world in a way that is currently relevant. Though our opinions should not be held with the same esteem as the biblical canon, we still carry the hope of Christ to the world. Our society has forgotten what it means to follow Christ. The bright lights of truth seekers are barely visible in the dim twilight of a post-Judeo-Christian society. We all see the darkness coming. All we can hope is to share the light that He has entrusted to us. This is Modern Apocrypha.
I'm listening to thunder. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear a thing. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Modern Apocrypha.
And we're recording while Greg is in the rain.
Apparently, I am. It's definitely a thunderstorm today.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we didn't actually mention in the last episode, but my seventh little one has arrived.
Indeed.
And that's a big thing here. It has, you know, it takes a huge amount of attention from the whole family for a while before the baby shows up, and then baby's here and things kind of, for me at least, return to where I can focus on other things that I've been doing and get back into, you know, for me, writing or whatever, which is cool. Yeah, so that's a thing.
It's also a great surprise. Got a new face, everything's all new again. It's always a fun time.
Absolutely. So, today there was something that occurred to me that I actually mentioned it to my kids. I asked my oldest, "What's wrong with this statement?" And he couldn't answer. And so I thought maybe it was worth sort of bringing it up here and talking about things that people don't understand that are just naturally part of existence. So, for example, the thing that we were talking about was a Facebook post. It was asking why Boeing has such a hard time competing with SpaceX when it comes to space technology. You know, they've been in the aerospace business for a lot of years. They've got all kinds of brain trust there. You would think that they would be able to do a better job than SpaceX, but they really can't even begin to compete. They can't even begin to keep up. You know, SpaceX is just a mile ahead and gaining. And there are things that I think people don't really understand that affect those things. So in this case, what I'm thinking of is the fact that Boeing is, what, it's like 100 years old now? Something like that?
I don't actually know. It's definitely a very mature company, though.
It is, and it's a very large company. And so the principle here that I'm sort of thinking of is that human institutions decay over time. And that when you get a really stellar new startup somewhere, and let's just use the numbers that we were talking about pre-show. Let's say you have 5 established companies and 10 startups. Of those 5 established companies, 4 of the 5 are going to keep chugging along statistically for a good amount of time. They're going to be pretty stable. They're actually a good bet because they've been around for a while. They've proven that they know what they're doing. And the 5th one might fall apart, but you know, 4 of the 5 are going to be good. Let's say you've
got 10. These are normal times, so this would have been, I don't know, 1990 until 2010, those 20 years would be a normal time. We lost Kodak, but all the other big companies were pretty okay, right? That's kind of.
Well, and even during market crashes, even like in 08 or, you know, whatever, you still, most of the big companies, they'll take a haircut, but they're okay. It's not a big deal. But then you have 10 startups and, you know, you'll have 6 of the 10 startups fail. 2 of the 10 startups just kind of barely manage to do anything. And then the other 2 absolutely take off like rockets and grow like crazy. And it's because you've got a lot of different principles interacting here. But the one that you have to understand is that if you compare those 2 startups to the established companies, say they're all in the same space, those 2 startups are going to do much better proportionally than the 4 existing companies are. The 2 that take off.
That, and it's because it does, because, tend, to, it does yeah, tend to.
Right. And it's because human institutions decay over time. When you have an established set of, you know, whatever it is, whether it's a government or a company or you name it, as time goes on, it will start to lose its effectiveness because the people who are involved in it don't have the same motivation to do well that they used to, and they don't have the same lack of rules and lack of baggage to, you know, that they have to carry along. So, for example, in the case of SpaceX, it's a pretty new company. It's only been around for 20 years or something. Not even that, I don't think.
Well, there's quite a bit about it that would not have passed the smell test to an established corporation. He began with Russian rockets, right? Oh no, big security risk. He went through many phases of let's get it done somehow, that then ended up in the long run giving him the ability to make anything in the super plant or whatever it may be. But the oomph, the I won't give up, you can't stop me from winning, whatever it takes, I'm cheating, I'm lying, killing, whatever it takes. That's a bit too far because that didn't happen. But the drive to win whatever game is being played falls away. And then the game itself that is being played in a mature company is the game of whatever that corporation's game is set up is, not me versus reality. It's in this closed off garden. How do I win in this small space?
Right. And that's true of militaries. That's true of countries. That's true of companies. That's true of churches. That's true of any human organization.
It feels like there's two bits here that people think of. One is that an idea does not succumb to entropy in the same way that physical objects do, but people interacting will bring a physical force into an idea. So you always hear people say, we're not doing it in the way the Constitution said. We're not doing it in the way that we did in the beginning, whatever, right? You fall away from the non-entropy idea when over time. You fall away from your ideas over time.
You do, unless they are, you know, rules that are just baked into how you do things and you can't change them, which is what the Constitution was supposed to be, but when they were able to overcome the rules, that kind of changed some. And so, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. That's true. And I think that the thing that people kind of just don't register here is this notion that when you have an old company or an old country or an old thing, it isn't going to, in its current form, just become the next big thing. It isn't going to, without a rebirth of some kind, and Jordan Peterson likes to talk about this, right, where the whole going to the underworld and saving his dead father and whatever, the whole thing he goes through, without a rebirth of some kind, it isn't going to become something new and powerful, new and stronger. And a lot of times something new has to come up to take its place. And
we also see similarities in the idea of like immigration and buying other companies with new ideas.
Yeah. Well, you see some of that, but a lot of times what ends up happening is the old company buys the new company and the new idea gets buried unless it has already been successful enough that the new company has a vested interest in keeping it rolling, in which case they are going to do a less good job at it than the people who had the company originally, if they had just kept going in the direction they were. They sold out too soon. You see the same thing with all kinds of intellectual property like Star Wars, like, you know, basically anything that humans create, you see this kind of deterioration. So what we need to be looking for is we need to be looking for new things that carry the best qualities of the old things, but also accomplish a goal better than the old things did. So I'm going to use the example of my own writing here. You know, when I wrote Bright Star and in this Energemetra 6 universe that I'm creating, I'm trying to use ideas that are the best ideas in the history of the world. It's Jesus's story. And the the truths of Christianity that he created that are the most important time-tested things that we possess ideologically. They just are. And I'm trying to bring them into a new sort of frame, a new story to tell people, because people need to hear the story. People need to hear the ideas. And that's the only way to do it that I can think of.
It's an interesting perspective on it, for sure. The reiteration of another, like, I don't want to take away any positivity here. But to tell the story again is not to tell a different story. You're not skewing away from, you're not trying to get people to move away from the original positive ideology in your story. You're reinforcing. You're right.
Yeah. Well, I am, but I'm also doing another thing too, where, you know, when you get an allegory, a lot of people with an allegory will just retell the story, and that's helpful. That's a good thing, especially if you have a way of telling it that it hasn't been told before. But if you can do something more, and what I'm meaning by that is, in the case of Christians, we are an allegory of Christ in a lot of ways. We live our lives to grow close to and point back to him. That means that we have the suffering that we go through as part of life that points back to him and what he did. And we suffer for him because we are his body. Now, that's getting into some pretty deep theological concepts there that we could explore at some point. But the idea here is that we are the allegory. So if I tell a story about a person who is a Christian, but whose life echoes that of Christ, I'm telling a story about an allegory that isn't exactly an allegory in itself. It's a story that becomes an echo of the original. Does that make any kind of sense?
It does. It does. And I find it most useful to, in the space of reinforcing, reiterating, without being repetitive and turning people off because, oh, I've heard that before.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and because of the way powers and principalities are what we wrestle with, the idea that the Christian faith is what it is is actually misrepresented and lied about across the culture. And so if you can find a way to give people a window into the truth of it, then you can jump past some of the lies that the enemy has tried to paint things with. And that's another thing. Back to the subject that we're talking about here, though, if that's all right. There were sort of four basic things that I came up with that I don't think a lot of people understand about the world that I sort of wanted to go through. So human systems decay is one of them. Another is that nothing is monolithic. Okay, and what I mean by that is we have this tendency when we talk about the government or, I mean, the example that's jumping to the front of my mind because of the current conversation is the Jews.
Huh, okay.
But we as human beings like to take a group and we like to paint them as being monolithic. We like to say that because they are such and such, we can count them all as being part of the group, and we can say that the group did this, or the group is this, or the group believes this.
It's a strange one because the group can do it without every individual in the group having done it. One individual out of a group can do a thing, and that group has done the thing.
Well, that's partially true, but this is sort of diving into what is and is not true about groups a little bit, not in a deep, deep way, but in kind of a, what would you call it, in at least a useful way, to say that, let's just take the government as an example. There are a lot of people I know who say that the government wants to take their guns. And, well, okay, so let's say that the person who's at the top of the government has some desire to confiscate your guns. We know Kamala Harris would love to confiscate all the guns in the country. She would love to do that. That's a thing.
If it got her a vote, if it got her a vote.
Even if it didn't, man, that's part of her agenda is to do that, whether or not it gets her votes. That's actually an incredibly unpopular position to have as across America. The Second Amendment is one of the things that we hold the most strongly, and it's incredibly unpopular, but it's still part of her agenda to take away people's guns. There is a particular interest group that will support her because she champions that, and that's fair, but it's overall not going to gain her votes. So to say that the whole government wants to take your guns because the person at the top has expressed an interest is still misleading, because we know that the Constitution says you can't do it, and the Supreme Court has been pretty solidly ruling against gun grabbing in the past few years. And so, obviously not the whole government, but does that mean that people saying that the government wants to take your guns is entirely false? Well, no, that's not entirely false. The other thing that we have to remember is that there are powers and principalities behind these things that do have agendas. And so to say that the powers and principalities that are trying to direct the government would prefer to take away the people's guns, I think is valid. I think they actually would. But that doesn't necessarily automatically mean that it's going to happen, or that every part of the group of people who make up the government agree with that agenda. Or even if they did, that they could accomplish that. But the point I'm trying to make is that when you point to a group and say, this group did this thing, you may be expressing something valuable, but you had better have done enough analysis to understand that that group is not monolithic, and that there are members of the group who are going to have differing opinions and want to go differing directions. So, for example, in the case of the government, let's move away from the guns thing here. The government wants to be a world empire. Well, that's actually not entirely true. There are plenty of people in the government who don't think that's a good idea, and even plenty of people in charge who don't see things that way. Then there are plenty of people in charge who do see things that way. And if it was forced to a decision point, which it may be in the very near future, we may be seeing a place where the U.S. government has to make a decision between we are the world police who are going to do, you know, whatever if China invades Taiwan, or whatever if, right, you pick the thing that on the geopolitical stage is taking attention. And Trump obviously does not do a lot of those things. He's not.
It's not a very wise position for a selfish person to be the one on top. You really would like to have a steady top that you can bounce around and take advantage of. Today, this thing, tomorrow, that thing, the next day, the next, you know. So bouncing around in a system is the most profitable way to do it. Just being at the top, as it were, is to pull yourself out of that system. And I don't feel like most humans have the capacity to even see what that would mean for themselves.
Well, and all I'm getting at is that when most people talk about these things, they let themselves default to this lazy analysis where they look at things as being monolithic. And we know, if we stop and think about it, that that's not true, but people still do it constantly. And it's really not valuable most of the time, because even when we're talking about powers and principalities, right? Even when we're talking about these spiritual beings that are against us, people like to say Satan did this or Satan did that, or the devil tried to do this to me, or the devil tried to do that to me. When the reality is they never met one of the top dogs on the spiritual stage. Who they met was something that was five rungs down the hierarchy that was trying to tempt them. And it's still true that that being was a member of that hierarchy, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that hierarchy is monolithic. And so let me give you an example of this, because people will actually balk at this one a lot of times. So let me trace it down just a little bit. We know in Revelation it says that the old dragon Satan has 7 heads and 10 horns, and those 7 heads are probably 7 different personalities or beings. Think of it as like an interdimensional artificial intelligences that are networked together.
I feel like there's a very, very important distinction in language here, because it says 7 heads, not 7 faces. A face is a personality. A head, something else. I don't know what.
It isn't just personality. It's a different being. There are 7 beings that are part of the same entity, as near as I can tell. So when we talk about the ancient pantheons of Greece or Egypt or whatever, do you really think that these ancient spiritual beings that we know are still on the stage today? It's like Jonathan Cahn's Return of the Gods book paints a pretty clear picture of what's going on there. There are lots of others. You look at Heiser, look at any number of these things. We know that there are still multiple spiritual beings in these pantheons that are around, whether it's Baal or Ishtar or Moloch or, there are a number of them.
And it's strange. Why would Baal and Ishtar be in the same bucket?
What do you mean?
Is it simply because the bucket of evil spirits as opposed to angels in service?
Well, we know that so the best way we can describe this is by looking at the people who worship these entities. And they are not serving the same entity. They are serving different entities, and those entities have differing goals and sometimes conflicting intents, right? That's just a fact. So the question then becomes, what do we do with that? Well, we know that on a spiritual level, these beings do not always act in concert. The only thing they all have in common is that their enemy is God. They are different personalities, they are different beings, but they are all part of the opposition to Christianity, to Christ, to God, which is Satan. And so when you look at that, you go, okay, sure, so what? But the idea is that when we have a conception of reality and we try to button things down as being, oh, this is all just Satan, this is all just Satan doing all this, well, technically you may be correct. It would be better if you said, it looks to me like I am under attack because this thing is going on. And so this particular spirit needs to get out of my house right now in Jesus's name. Wouldn't it?
It would help.
And that's what I'm advocating, is to understand your enemies, understand your friends, understand the forces at work around you. Do not point to things, whether they're spiritual, physical, human, whatever, as being monolithic, unless they really are. The closest thing we have to a monolithic entity is the triune God. God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, because they act in concert all the time. They do not do things that are in opposition to each other. They are different beings, but they are as close to monolithic as we can conceive of, with different personalities. Nothing else in the world is.
Nothing. Nothing.
that
you might argue if you get small enough, there's a string as a mono thing, but even that's up for debate. Everything.
Well, and even you as a human being, our listeners or ourselves, do you really think that you are a monolithic being? Are there not competing forces inside of you? Does part of you not want ice cream and part of you not want to not put on weight because you're eating lots of sugar? Because, you know, we all have these conflicting desires inside of us. And to say that we even are monolithic might be not putting enough analysis on things depending on the situation. So, here's a great example of that, huh?
Completely, undeniably, we are not monolithic, because your right brain, left brain are thinking the same thing all the time, and they'll diverge. So you're always, as a physical being, not capable of being monolithic.
Well, let's take this a step further. There are people who say that person is evil. He does X. Well, what does that mean? Because as a human being, I have a desire to do all kinds of evil things. I have a desire to punch people in the face because they're mean to me. I have a desire to, I mean, you name it. You know, we don't even need to go down the list. The point is, as human beings, we have all of these desires. There are people who give in to these more than others. That does not make them a purely evil being. They are not a monolithic being. It's like a lot of people make Trump a total bugaboo. And when you think about the way Trump is, he's narcissistic. He's, you know, kind of bombastic. He likes to exaggerate, but he also has things about him that are good. Those are not good things, right? Being narcissistic and bombastic, those things are kind of icky and not very attractive. Yeah. But he does have things about him that are good. He actually seems to care about people to some degree. You know, provided they don't oppose him in the wrong way,
right.
He seems to care about people. He actually seems to care about America to a degree. He seems to understand the way things work better than a lot of the government does. So there are things about Trump that are good. There are things about Trump that are bad. Trump is not monolithic. Nobody is monolithic. And whether it's a serial murderer, a serial killer, or the person who was just sainted by the Catholic Church because they did so many good things in their life, they're not monolithic. We all sin. We all fall short. We all have these things inside of us that push us in different directions. And so pointing to a human being because you don't understand what they're doing as being monolithic is not wise.
Certainly, certainly. And it allows you, again, to be lazy and not think about things through in the full measure of predictive.
Right.
You haven't taken in enough to give a predictive answer yet.
I heard a story about Stalin recently. He went and visited his mom before she died. And he told her something about how he was like a tsar now. He was the most powerful person in the country. And she told him something about how he should care more about what he was like than about his position or something like that. And that's valuable and valid. And the point is that none of the figures that we see in history, whether it's Mao or Hitler or Stalin or any of the evil, you know, none of them were monolithic either. They made some really evil choices. But all of us are capable of those same choices. Anyway, that's enough on that one. Should we take a quick break and then come back and talk about the other two?
We should.
All right. We'll be back in a minute.
Back in a minute, everyone.
As you can probably tell from the backdrop, there are new things happening here. This is my new sound studio for recording audiobooks. It's not quite done, but it's done enough that I can record an ad in it, and that's exciting. I also have an anthology that I'm just finishing now. It should be coming out real soon. I have book 2 in the Bright Star series is basically finished, other than some professional edits and the publishing, and I'm pushing on that pretty hard. I'm hoping that there will be news on that one in the near future. When it comes to audiobooks, I'm planning on recording both the anthology and Bright Star. And folks, I need support and help now more than ever. Bright Star is doing just fine. I'm perfectly happy with it, and I am expanding both my ground game and my marketing game, and things are just growing. But the best recommendation is a recommendation from a friend. So if you like what you see on Modern Apocrypha, take this as a recommendation to you. Bright Star is worth your time. And if you've read it and you like it, recommend it to somebody. Help me out getting the word out about this series. And be on the lookout. More's coming soon. Energemetrix6.com, E6Universe.com, promo code Israel, 10% off.
Hello, Modern Apocrypha listeners. I'd like to take a moment to lift up North Arrow Coffee. If you're like me, you enjoy quite a bit of coffee, and North Arrow has a lot of really good coffees. But they're also following their very own North Star to support pro-life organizations. At North Arrow, 15% of all sales go towards life, not just for a limited time, but for a reason. So, if you'd like to support the podcast, you can use the code E6 at the North Arrow web store and save 10% today. Thank you.
And we're back.
Welcome back, everybody.
So we had two other things we wanted to sort of go over here. One of them is that central planning is impossible. And that could be read on a number of levels, but the basic thing, it kind of fits with nothing being monolithic. And here's why. When you have different entities, different beings in a system, and they have different goals, you cannot, from a central place, determine the value of each individual entity's objective. Okay, so let's take this in terms of economics. Let's say you've got 50 people who all live in a village, and they all have different desires, different goals. They have different houses they live in. They have different, you know, food that they like, whatever it is. From a central planning perspective, you cannot take each of those people and average out their desire for things to determine what the value is of a given object, whether it's strawberries or, you know, hay or gasoline, whatever it is. You can't take all of that into one place and decide what the comparative values of things are, because the individual actors in the system are the ones who make that judgment, and it changes so quickly that there is no possible way. It's actually fundamentally impossible to central plan an economy.
Would you take a moment to look at this on the specifics of Audible? Right now, they're tearing up small business people or individual writers, just stealing their money, right? Not even providing them with the tracking of what they've sold of their product. But on top of that, there's no distinguishing the most terrible, trashy, written in China, translated by a computer and 2 hours long, to, for the same price as a 50-hour classic. I mean, like, Sense and Sensibility. I don't know. Pick a classic. Okay. Well, right? Pick a classic.
I'm with you.
It's the same price as the 2 hour, barely in English, computer translated junk. Right? So again, you've got this top down determination, not from the bottom up, as in the customer saying, these things are roughly in this group. These things are not the group I gave it. These things belong in the group that nature provided it. And that, right, that's going to be a cost that people are willing to pay. Not,
yeah,
I put things on paper between a binding and called it what you called your work, and so I deserve what you deserve. Right?
I'm actually glad you brought up that example. That's a really good example. It's central planning that's happening around us today all the time, where we look at central planning as being something that communists do. Well, the reality is, central planning tends to happen in any circumstance where too many people put their reliance on a single organization to, you know, determine the value of something or whatever. It's like when you put your product in Walmart as a manufacturer, it's really, really hard to compete there, because the value of the things that are on the shelf is divorced from the consumer's ability to determine the value of the product. So one of the things that I make a principle of my life is to try to do business with and shop from local businesses, from small businesses, whether that's in people whose products I'm representing and selling myself. Like, you know, we're going to be going to, actually listeners might be interested, we're going to 7 different cons and conventions. I will be going to a number of them. You will be probably at a few of them at least. I don't know. We haven't worked it all out yet, but the point is I've got 7 I have signed up for of cons, conventions, shopping things, whatever, for the next, before the end of December that we'll be doing this stuff. And when I do business with people, I want to represent small businesses. I want to represent people who really take joy in what they're creating and who, you know, all of those things. I don't want to, if I have a choice, buy a mass produced product from somebody overseas that, you know, I'll do that some, but that isn't what I want to be my mainstay. Sure. And likewise in my individual life, I don't shop at big box stores any more than I can help. I like to buy stuff from local producers. I like to buy stuff from, you know, farmers, from whatever. I try to make it a principle of my life to keep things that way. And if more people did that, we would actually see a better quality of life, and we would see a more, we would actually see more growth in the ability of people to create good products.
I would say, on my particular opinion on that one, that would be like sloganizing that particular, that would making a monolithic structure of the small business. And I want to take small business against Walmart, against overseas, and see who's making the best product for the best prices, and everybody can deal.
Well, okay, so here's a question. Is Walmart being subsidized by your tax dollars and the small business isn't? And do you have a responsibility then to try to go with the people who are producing the better product, even if they're not being subsidized by your tax dollars? Because big companies are being subsidized by our tax dollars. They are definitely, the products they're selling are being sold at a lower price than they ought to be in a free market. So, right. So you know, I agree with you in one sense. We need to buy the best product for the best price, but we also have to understand that there's a lot of manipulation going on. And so it is just better to do business with people who are able to, where you're able to talk to the person who's making the thing. Even if it's a case of, like, you know, there's a guy who I met a few months back at a convention, who is having Lego men made, and he sells them at cons all across the country. And when he does that, he is dealing with larger companies to get those injection molding molds made and to get the injection molding done, and they send him the product, but he's still not just a cog in the machine. He has actually started his own business, and he's using them as a subcontractor, and that's still way healthier than trying to go through somebody who's, you know, like Procter & Gamble or whatever. It's just better.
Certainly better if you want to get something illegal like Lego Men, right? It's certainly better if you want to get something that the
they're not illegal.
The point being is that the thing that Walmart wouldn't do without a signed contract with whoever owns the name Lego, an individual can do, and you may want some design that they won't.
I don't like the way you pulled this off target, man. That's not even true. Lego doesn't own the ability to make those building blocks shapes. There are people like Micro Mega Blocks and whatever that were in Walmart when I was a kid. So there are many companies that make those sorts of building blocks, and they're sold by Walmart and other big companies. So no, what I'm saying is that as you can, you want to deal with the smaller person who's making a good product if you can. Now, that isn't always possible. We buy plenty of stuff at Walmart.
And certainly it's very much like a fishing story. Do you want to get the fish from the market that's been sitting out on a table all day, or do you want to go to the fisherman that's just pulled it out of the water and give you a fresh fish? Right? Obviously, the closer to the source you can get, it's going to be a better quality in a lot of cases. But I think the target being best quality, lowest price, and factoring in real cost, because your tax consideration does affect cost, right? Not just price. Yeah. So if you factor in true price and true cost and true quality, you're getting the best quality at the best price.
That's what markets are for, and they're good.
That's what they're supposed to be for.
Right, that's really right. I'm with you. Yeah, shall we move on to the last one here?
Well, just to reiterate, because we went off on such a tangent, that point is that fundamentally it is not possible to centrally plan. It is not fundamentally a possibility. Someone says that, they're blowing smoke.
Yeah.
Come along.
Yeah, and if they believe it, then they are confused. Either they're lying to you or they're confused. Do not put them in charge of something because it's going to be bad.
Right.
Okay, so then the final one is this notion of, and I don't even know exactly how to introduce this one, except to say there's this this concept since I was a kid that these journalists over here are objective.
Right, objectivity.
Objectivity, right. Okay, that concept is fundamentally false.
There is
no concept of objectivity is fundamentally false. So where this is going, go ahead and read that sentence the way you had it written down.
Sure. Ideologies and relationships are always attached to every decision, perspective, and opinion.
Right. So where I'm going with that one is basically whatever we believe, it's going to affect what we do. And what we do is always going to be affected by what we believe. Even if what we believe is not well-informed or is not well-formulated, it's going to change the way we deal with the world. So when you deal with, or when you look at someone who claims to be a scientist who is trying to be objective, they have convinced themselves of something that is fundamentally impossible.
They've confused objectivity with godlessness?
Yeah, all too often. All too often. And what that means is, let's actually dive into that just a little bit, because that ought to be unpacked. Most people seem to think that in the scientific world, most people in the scientific spheres seem to think that if you count God as being a part of your worldview or as being a part of the way you think about something, that you have damaged your objectivity and your ability to look at something without bias. Well, the reality is,
which is hilariously backwards, because science originated in the Christian church and was carried, the torch was carried by Christians for like 350 years. So sure.
Right, where the real perspective there is that whatever we do, whatever we try to investigate is going to be affected by our worldview. And so the best we can do a lot of times to compensate for that is to state our worldview up front, to let people know where we're sitting, where we're coming from, and at the same time to try to understand where we're coming from ourselves so we can go, what might be the flaws in my own belief system that lead me to see things in an incorrect fashion, right? That's the best we can do a lot of times. There is no divorcing ideology from facts. We can't do it. We don't have the capacity to do it. Even God doesn't really do that when he communicates with us. You know, a lot of anything that is shown in the Bible is driven by God's goodness. It is driven by God's character. He does not divorce his perspective from his communication or from his understanding. It's all of a piece. So this idea that we ought to be objective is actually bad. It's actually bad. What we ought to do instead is we need to compensate for any error that we think we might have by stating our positions on things and by trying to imagine what our errors might be. But trying to be objective is going down a trail that is just saying, I'm opening myself up to blindness because I can't see where I'm sitting anymore.
Yep, for sure.
So now the other half of that, is the other half of the sentence that you read there, right? And that is that our relationships, well, there are two parts to it, sort of. Relationally, we always attach to things, right? So whether that's...
Sports teams are a really good one to represent that. Sports teams? Oh,
tell me.
Just because you feel like you are a Steeler, you are a 49er, you are a... A Texan is the name of a Houston football team, I believe. I'm not a sports guy, but people that are very big
Bronco.
Into
this. Denver right, Broncos.
Denver Broncos, yeah. So people feel like they are a part of that group. They feel like they're playing. They feel like they won, right?
Right. Well, and that's true in a great number of arenas, right? We attach ourselves relationally to whatever group or idea we favor. And this is a thing that we have to understand about ourselves in order to have a view that is not twisted by what we believe. Okay, so another example on the other end of the spectrum is one that you brought up. There are lots of women in this society who attach themselves to the state, and the state is what provides for them. The state is what, you know, they make their decisions based on what political figures say. There's this whole thing where they have essentially married the state. Or,
yeah. Well, it's a misplacement of the particular attachment, because the attachment that people have for their nation is not the attachment they have for their husband or wife, their spousal relationship. So mixing up a spousal relationship with a national relationship is the strange mix-up.
Well, and we need to understand that we tend to attach to things, and we tend to attach to things in ways where if we don't deal with the attachment properly, it's going to attach to something improperly. And that's sort of what I was getting at by bringing up that example is, so let's say, how many people are living outside of a married relationship, but living together with someone of the opposite sex in this country today, percentage-wise, compared to 50 years ago?
I would argue, and I know that this isn't a place that we agree, so it's going to be a hard one, but if you're living positively with a spouse off paper, but following all the rules of the biblical marriage, that's better than signing a piece of paper and B-slapping your wife across the room because you have a piece of paper saying you're allowed to.
Okay, so I know that we don't disagree on what you just said. We actually agree on what you just said. I think so too. But what I would say here is that when you commit to someone and you have committed to them in every way, I don't care about the piece of paper. I never have. I have never cared about the piece of paper from the government. I care about what my family thinks. I care about what my friends think. I care about what, you know, what God thinks. I care about what the other person thinks. I was committed to my wife before I ever got that piece of paper. That was a formality to me. I did it because it seemed like a thing that was needed, because when we marry somebody, putting up all of the fences to keep us in that place, because it's so hard to stay that way sometimes,
and I just
can
see
be an important
way.
Thing.
Yeah. I just see it the opposite way.
Well, okay, so to me, it seemed like a very important thing because it was part of the picture, but it wasn't something I particularly cared about myself. But the whole point I'm making here is that there are people who have divorced the committed relationship from the actual living situation. And that's not a good thing. You're actually attaching you're attaching something that God made for you to attach to a permanent partner, to someone who you are practicing to walk away from someday. So however you want to talk about it, fundamentally, what I'm objecting to right here is the idea that we attach ourselves to someone who we are practicing to walk away from. That's an abuse of this thing inside of us that is meant to have a permanent attachment. It's intended. It's something that we honor. people who've been married for 80 years, we honor that, man. That's impressive. That's amazing. That's good. 60 years, 40 years even, you know, you get up there and you go, wow, that's really cool.
They're still married. I think 2025 is about where it starts to be like, hey, you're doing great. Wow.
Most people are. Sure it is. And my whole point, though, is that we all feel that admiration. This is a natural part of us that we see that that's impressive and good that they did that. And it's good to see that it's not a good thing to walk away from that. And I'm not calling condemnation down on anybody here. I'm just saying that as human beings, we need to intentionally attach the way we're supposed to attach, or we're going to do it in a way that hurts ourselves. And this is the way that our society does the most commonly that hurts us, is to attach yourself to someone you're practicing to walk away from. Okay, that's one of the things that is most harmful in our current society. There are plenty of other examples, though. You should not be attaching yourself to a sports team as part of your identity. Your sports team should not be a part of what you think of yourself. It's fine to watch sports. That's great. But sports teams should not be part of your identity, because that's a fundamental misunderstanding of what our identities are intended to be grounded in. Our identities are intended to be grounded in Jesus Christ.
Indeed. Another common sort of older concept of that would be rooting for your military in some way, right? They are you because they're your military, but you're not there, right? And so you don't get the medal, even though you feel good that you won.
Right. Well,
so it is purposely taking advantage of a thing inside of us that they figured out was inside of us, and they said, hey, we can make money if we...
Well, and there's a healthy part of that, right? It's like saying, if you personally are facing a totally anarchic thing where you have to defend your house and your family against, you know, whatever's coming at you, I'm going to be rooting for you, dude. I am. So there's value in this whole thing, but we have to be careful not to misplace it, because we're constantly incentivized by the society around us to misplace these attachments, whatever they are, these relationships. And it is in the enemy, the spiritual enemy's interest to get us to do exactly that.
Sure. You find people that try to escape it as if it's a good thing to escape, saying that they are attempting to be utterly logical, like logic is some master that won't lead them wrong. But somehow they love logic, but they're afraid AI is going to turn the universe into a paperclip. But those don't go together in their mind.
Well, and in the end, what you're talking about is rejecting the idea of attachments, probably because they've been hurt by former attachments, probably. But this all has to come from the basic understanding that we were made by a God who made us to have these attachments, and that we have to direct them properly, or they will direct themselves improperly. So you have friends who, well, hopefully, I mean, you know, you have friends who you trust, who you relate to, who are essentially your brothers in all but blood, right? Whatever. You have a spouse who you attach to in a different way. It's even a deeper attachment, maybe, but it's a different kind of attachment. You don't want to confuse those things exactly. Though
you're a horrible, horrible Freudian thing, mixing up spouse and mom. Or no, that's not Freudian.
It is.
It starts with an E, doesn't it?
I don't know, but it is Freudian.
Yeah, it's from Freudian, but there's a dude with an E. Oedipus.
Oh, well, okay, so that's older than Freud, but...
But to mix up the where your attachments go can be really gross.
It can. Well, and so be aware of where your attachments are and intentionally put them in the right places. One of the things that our society has sort of told us is a good thing is following our attachments as if they were our masters, rather than attaching our attachments to the correct things and mastering them. I aspire to master my attachments and put them in the proper places so that I'm attached to my wife because she's my wife, my parents because they are my parents and I honor them, my friends because they are my brothers in all but blood, my children because I am their dad and it is my job to raise them up and to help them to grow. They're not my friends and they are not my parents. They are my children. Maybe they can be my friends someday, but I'll always be their dad. Right? We got to have those attachments in the proper places. And if we don't do it on purpose, we fall prey to it. Go ahead.
I have a question on a similar pitfall. I'm going to use a very specific example, but it's more general than this specific example. Say that you've got a group of friends, like all the guys at the Daily Wire. And so they bring in someone like Candace Owens and they make a friend because they're all friends. Are they messing up because they're offering something to someone in a position that doesn't meet the other criteria of everyone else in that position, and so it's too soon? Or, like, I see a problem where we've given this to everyone else, and you've hit the same spot they've hit, so you get it too, being a problem there.
You know, there are two factors in here. One of those is the male-female dynamic, and that is... Well, that becomes inextricably tangled with the other part of the question you're asking. I think that if we understand our attachments properly, so for example, let's say I were to sell a whole bunch of books and I made a whole bunch of money and I was able to hire a team of people, I would look to the people who helped me when I didn't have anything as more trustworthy than the people I'm hiring because they have proven that they have that bond with me. I'm not going to give the people who I hire automatic trustworthiness just because they, you know, they're part of my team now. And that's another thing that I think people don't actually understand about the way God works and the way Jesus does things is he said, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." The idea is that we who follow him now, when he is not here in the visible physical, are doing something that gain us a position of trust and honor that is above what will be when he is here in the physical and visible, because we believed when he wasn't here. That's just a function of reality and of how things work. So no, I don't think it's appropriate to give away a relationship status to someone just because they have met the same criteria as somebody else. But in terms of Candace, do I think it was appropriate that they were including her in their backstages and talking with her about ideas while she was there? Yeah, I think that's appropriate, but...
Well, I don't think that that's what I would be bothered by. I think the thing that hit them was the heart pain of having a friend you've got to say negative things to or whatever. This is no longer an employee. This is someone brought into a soft space. And if they've never brought you into the soft space, then they can tell you, this is the way it is, have fun.
Well, and that's relationship for you. You know, you choose to trust people and they hurt you. And that's actual damage, it's actual pain, it's actual harm that is done. And you have to learn to grow past that, to forgive, to move on, but not to allow them to abuse you by repeating the mistake, but to have healthy boundaries. They chose a bad person to bring into their circle of trust. It was a mistake. I knew it at the time because of who she was and what she was like, but you know, what can I say? Yeah, we make mistakes. We're human.
Yeah. I think that that's probably another space to just be wary of is seeing someone making the same moves as someone else doesn't mean that they're putting together the same paragraph in their overall storyline. Yeah,
I'm with you. Hey, we're about done here. We might actually be over time. Anything else you want to hit before we call it?
I did want to go over the list just for anybody so that it's there.
Yeah, sure.
Human systems, organizations will decay. They are subject to entropy. Number two, nothing is monolithic. There's no single thing all the way through, whether it's an organization, a person, nothing is monolithic. Central planning is not possible. The top-down planning is another way to say it.
Yeah.
It's just physically, it's just not a thing that can happen. And then objectivity is a falsehood, and it should be. You should recognize your perspective and
your attachments.
And your attachments.
Awesome. Thanks for being here, everybody. We will catch you next time.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.